Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies China Energy Program. My name is Anders Hovey, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute, and today we are back for a general taking stock of the China energy picture almost at mid-year. We're recording this podcast on the 19th of May, 2023. And now that we have a lot of statistics, as well as more color on the first quarter of the year, we're going to discuss the Chinese economy, oil and gas demand, the situation with coal, energy security, climate policy, and other things related to energy in China. I'm speaking today with Mikhail Maidan, Director of the China Energy Program at the Institute, as well as with Philip Andrew Speed, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute. Let's jump right in. My first question is for Mikhail. There have been lots of questions about China's reopening and economic recovery. How strong is it? How sustainable is it? Have we gleaned any new insights from the first quarter or from April data releases? Where do we stand on our assessment of the Chinese economy and energy?
I guess the easy thing to say is that we said it was going to be long and complicated and that the China reopening trade was perhaps overly bullish. So the easy thing to say is we're kind of still in that sentiment and data is still somewhat confusing. We have to bear in mind that Q1 data includes January, February, which is the Lunar New Year. So a lot of distortions just because of that, and the year-on-year comparisons are tricky. But in terms of what we have actually seen in terms of data, clearly a recovery. All the metrics are sort of pointing up. We had 4.5% GDP growth in the first quarter, which was very positive. Consumer spending and retail sales very clearly up, confirming sort of the revenge spending narrative and, you know, the opening up and people again out and about and spending. April data again shows strong retail sales. Fixed asset investments up, industrial output growing too. This is where the nuance perhaps or the slightly more cautious take comes in. These were lower than expectations. Fixed asset investments, for example, grew more slowly than March levels. But again, this is where the data is tricky. Like April year-on-year comparisons are from a very low base. So that is slightly distortive in what we're seeing. But again, that there was this expectation in the market that everything would be extremely bullish, and that is being tempered now. What does that mean? Strong growth, a recovery for sure, still led by consumer spending, which is where the government wants it to be. Weaker on the industrial side of things. Real estate sector still worrying from the perspective of its ability to boost growth and commodity demand. But the fact that it's not booming is good on the kind of emissions and sustainability front. Industrial outputs have been stronger again in the first 4 months of the year, but coal production, for instance, was slightly lower in April compared to March. Unemployment still a big issue. So I think we go back to what we have been flagging and talking about is this issue of sentiment and confidence, which will take time to restore.
And big question is, what does this mean for oil and gas demand this year versus expectations versus last year? Where do we look on oil and gas demand?
Oil demand, I think the consensus has been transport fuels will be up. Clearly, jet has been soaring. Like we've had more than double digit, like almost doubling of jet consumption year on year. And that has been, you know, open travel and people able to move around. Gasoline has been equally strong. Obviously, we have Q1 data, but anecdotally, the May holiday saw a surge in transport and in people moving around in every possible way. So those have been up and up strongly, and that is very much sort of expectations. Diesel is interesting because diesel is obviously a very industrial fuel, and it's been strong, perhaps stronger than sort of construction and industrial activity would suggest. Now, part of that might be, and I think we talked about this, the kind of supply-demand balances, right? Because the data we have is implied demand. We don't know how much has gone into storage. So how much of what is produced is stocked to be used at a later date and how much is actually being consumed. So some of that could be distortive, but interestingly, some of the diesel strength could be backup generation because of power outages or concerns about power outages this summer. We already have droughts in Yunnan. We've already got some rationing. So diesel might be tied into that. Gas consumption has also recovered. But I mean, so, you know, some of the stats and NDRC stats are showing, you know, gasoline up 33% and jet up again 99%, diesel 24%. So very strong growth for Q1. Gas consumption, again, if we look at NDRC data, is recovering 3% in Q1, but again, a very strong rebound in March. And that's really driven by industrial use. A lot of refining and chemicals, again, which is strong. The smelting, sort of a lot of gas in industries used by metals, that is probably weaker, again, related to the construction side of things. And I think gas and power is the open question for the year because of the looming energy shortages. Hydro levels are low in the south. Economic activity, again, recovering but not skyrocketing. There could be more demand for gas and power, also because global prices have fallen. So some of the industrial users and the tier two buyers are coming back into the market, taking up more spot LNG. But I would caution that with the fact that the policy signals on gas have been quite cautious. Most notably, the National Energy Administration, in its guidance for this year, has said that the government needs to review its gas utilization policy. So I think that's an interesting one to note with sort of gas between coal and renewables. I mean, for this year, we're still optimistic. We've got 20 to 25 BCM of gas demand growth, of which probably 6 to 8 BCM of incremental consumption is LNG. But sort of just planting a flag out there to kind of say potentially downside risk for demand in the kind of longer term. But I want to actually, that's a good transition, I think, to you, Philip, to talk about coal and what's been happening with coal consumption and trade. What have you been seeing and any thoughts on this?
Well, Mikhail, despite the relatively low economic growth compared to expectation, the production and consumption and imports of coal are all up for the first 4 months of the year. And therefore, carbon dioxide emissions for the first 4 months are up about 4%. So, you know, this is not good news from the point of view of constraining carbon emissions. The biggest sector from the point of view of emissions from coal in the first 4 months has been power generation. And as you've sort of alluded to, that's because of a shortage of hydro in the south. If the hydro had been operating as normal, then coal consumption in power generation might even have been down. The other big user of coal has been steel and cement for construction, because that is a sector that is moving ahead. Looking forwards, we're seeing more approvals for new coal-fired power plants. But at the same time, you know, wary of safety issues, they have been suspending some mines from production. So, yes, coal is growing. Emissions are growing, at least so far this year.
So we've been talking a lot about, you know, the relative importance of economic growth, environmental protection, and we've been, I guess, taking the pulse on that as we go. How are you thinking about that now, Philip? Any changes to your views? Anything that's kind of standing out to you in that balance?
No, I think roughly the same as before. I mean, the top priority is short-term economic growth, you know, building back after COVID. But as we've seen, it hasn't been as strong as hoped. And against that as well, we're seeing youth unemployment is marginally up again to 20%. And this is a big problem for the government. And again, if we look at energy, security of energy supply is extremely important. With the hot summer coming, if it's going to be like last summer, then they'll be relying a lot on coal because the hydro will not be as available. I'm currently in Hainan. Fortunately, on the east side of the island, because the west side of the island had temperatures in excess of 40 degrees centigrade a week or so ago in early May, as did much of southern China. So we could be in for a long, hot, dry summer. And yes, the environmental agenda with carbon emissions, that is still there. But that is medium and long term. It's not in the short term about how do we get through 2023.
And I just add to that, that there have been increasing concerns about the changes in air quality this year, seemingly connected, although not necessarily every single day, because there have also been some very major dust storms, which tends to be much more weather driven as opposed to anything related to policy or economy. But in terms of PM2.5, which is the major air pollution, ambient air quality issue in northern China, it's also been worse this year than in previous years. And during the two sessions, despite various policy measures to tamp down on emissions, nevertheless, it was one of the worst air quality periods in recent Beijing history. And I think that there's the concern that not only is the economy the priority, but also the air quality targets are currently not being emphasized this year with the completion of the last plan for air quality, even though air quality was mentioned quite prominently in the government work report and two sessions documents. So that's also something to watch on the whole issue of the balance between economy versus energy security versus environmental quality.
And it's interesting, right? There's the air pollution plan, the long-running ones, and then we've had pretty much every winter the government issuing kind of short-term measures for the winter that we didn't have this year, which goes to your point about the air quality in Beijing during the two sessions. I mean, is there scope for a reversal in policies if all of a sudden with all this coal we get, you know, a worsening of air pollution later on in the year? I mean, that's again one thing to watch out for. But in our conversations, I think Philip, you've been a bit more cautious, and Anders, you've been telling us the more optimistic side of the story, or at least the kind of renewable side of the story. So tell us what you've seen, or any news on the renewables front that you think is worth flagging.
It's interesting. China had a very good first quarter in terms of installation of new renewable energy. So over 33 gigawatts of solar PV installed so far this year as the first quarter. And that's up over 100% from the prior year, and would put China way ahead of what's necessary to meet the different projections and targets for how much wind and solar are going to be added in this whole year. The wind capacity additions more in line with historical, just 10 gigawatts. And then the wind and solar production have maybe not kind of kept pace with the actual new installations this year, which is interesting and still looking into why. I think it's interesting as well to hear what the government is saying about renewables, especially given the acceleration of construction of various coal plant capacity around the country. First of all, we've heard for the first time a little bit of pushback on the additions of new coal and whether or not that's going to have a long-term increase in emissions associated with that, whether that will result in stranded assets as these assets are being used less as renewables are built out. And furthermore, we're also seeing the government really trying various different measures to accelerate renewables construction in these clean energy bases. There was a new policy to standardize land use for PV plants, and that policy did prioritize plants for the Gobi Desert area, which has presumably less conflicts with other land uses. I think distributed solar is also likely to do very well this year. And then also on the policy front, we have to look at kind of the balance between markets and policies, especially policies at the provincial level and local levels, which sometimes have tended to prefer coal versus renewables, or at least have preferred coal when it comes to project approvals. NEA came out with a new implementation plan for the new energy system, and this plan reiterates the requirement for full purchase of renewable energy. That's a Chinese definition that doesn't actually require 100% purchase, but more a purchase of a reasonable number of operating hours from wind and solar. And this document includes a new interesting phrase, which is that renewable integration should be planned-based and market-assisted. In addition, this plan calls for acceleration of energy storage and for energy storage to participate in power markets using a contract for difference. And then finally, it talks about how important it is for the distribution system, the distribution power lines, to have greater transparency around the installations of distributed energy, and points out an interesting example from Fujian province of a county that is providing quarterly data on new distributed energy installed in different grids locally, that it can help installers and energy companies and grid companies manage the additions of solar and their impact on the grid. The implementation plan, finally, last point, NEA put a lot of emphasis on kind of naming and shaming provinces and local officials for basically, now that renewables have reached grid parity, loading on a bunch of extra and unreasonable costs onto new renewable energy projects. And that threatens the energy transition and could reverse this trend towards grid parity of renewables. The NEA cited the examples from Northwest China, where places were requiring new wind plants to build a 6-kilometer tourist road free of charge in order to get approval. And this, you know, this added a very significant cost to the energy production from this plant. And so basically the NEA is saying for new projects, really, provinces and local officials cannot just levy new fees and force companies to make donations or build extra infrastructure, because that unreasonably drives up the cost. So I think it's interesting to see. I think in the last month or so, there have been more policies and more chatter about the need to really stay on course with the clean energy transition.
Interesting as well. I mean, the NEA naming and shaming harks back, I think, to what provinces are used to with fossil fuel companies. And we've seen, I think it was cities in Tianjin province trying to pass the buck and asking SOEs to invest more in that infrastructure. So sort of saying, look, we're cash strapped. We need the big companies to step in and help us. But also to your point, Xi Jinping was in Shanxi, right? The biggest, a big fossil fuel hub, one of the biggest coal producers in China. He also called on the province to promote the low carbon energy transition. So clearly, I think as Philip was saying, there's a short-term emphasis on getting through the summer and then the winter, but longer term, the plans remain. I want to switch tack a little bit because there seem to have been lots of developments on tech and innovation. Now, there are constantly developments on tech and innovation in China, but a few headlines actually caught my eye on CATL and sodium ion batteries and perovskite PV production lines. Anders, you follow this much more closely than I do. What do you make of the, I mean, is it a big step forward? Are there really big developments? And what do they mean?
I always tend to be a little bit cautious about any of the big press release announcements when they come out. But you're right, the flurry of different innovation-related announcements on the both battery and solar front has been higher than usual, I'd say. And definitely what CATL, the world's largest battery manufacturer and just the company that dominates electric vehicle supply chains worldwide, they have had a couple of very intriguing announcements. The most press around is the issue of sodium ion batteries. Sodium group one element could replace lithium in the current technology, lithium ion batteries for certain applications, maybe because this would offer a lower energy density, but a lower cost. Perhaps these would be for a different type of vehicle, lower cost or larger vehicles. But anyway, having a substitute for lithium ion batteries would be a quite impressive way of resolving some of the material shortages in the lithium space. And it's really extraordinary that CATL is talking with BYD as well as with Chery to put these in vehicles by the end of this year. And, you know, that's not something that I would normally expect to see in a press release about a new technology. Similarly, CATL made an announcement just in the last few weeks about a new condensed battery, which offers energy density of over 500 watt hours per kilogram. And that is just an extraordinary figure. We don't know anything about kind of the cost, I don't think, but this is the type of battery where if that panned out, it could mean that we move more quickly to batteries in some very difficult applications, like, for example, in air transport. I think that one might be a little bit longer in the future, although, again, CATL promised that this would be available quite in the near term. On perovskites as well, perovskite is a type of material which could be intriguing for solar photovoltaics, either on its own or in tandem with other solar materials. There have been various announcements from China in the last few years. And, you know, right now we're looking at announcements talking about both new efficiency records, new types of materials that are more stable for perovskites, always the historic problem with developing perovskite materials for commercial use is their instability or short lifetimes. And then, as you mentioned, press releases surrounding actually manufacturing of perovskites for commercial deployment. So that one I would be a little bit more skeptical about, but perovskites have been a long time in coming. They've been moving mostly at the lab scale. And if there could be something that actually brings them into the market, then we'll start to know more about what the prospects for that technology is. Overall conclusion on this topic would be, you know, that China continues to be a very strong leader in the innovation space for both solar and battery technology. And so China should not be viewed as simply a low-cost manufacturing center for these technologies.
It's quite striking as well, the headlines about Ford giving up on the Chinese market, obviously oversimplifying some of the headlines, and outflows of Chinese, I think it was China surpassed Japan as the exporter of vehicles. A lot more to come, I think. Let's change direction again a little bit. Talk about foreign policy. Lots happening in the South China Sea, just as Xi Jinping is hosting Central Asian leaders in town. Philip, I think you've been looking at that recently. What's been going on and what are your thoughts?
Well, I was speculating to start with. I mean, with China is trying to build back some friendships, I think. So, you know, they've got tensions with the US. Its best friend to the north, Russia, is a little unreliable, to say the least. So, yeah, it's reaching out westwards and southwards. Southwards, in the South China Sea, been the number two from Singapore has been in China, for example, and there's been a meeting in the last couple of days of senior officials from ASEAN, Southeast Asia, and China to make progress on the code of conduct to regulate behavior in the South China Sea. This is due to complete its second reading by the end of the year. Now, of course, this whole idea of having a code of conduct goes back 21 years. So this is hardly a massive rate of progress, but there does seem to be a slight acceleration, and so that's good. But set against that, we've had a recent flare-up in tensions between Vietnam and China when Vietnam started exploring in new areas that sort of moved further east from Vietnam's coast, but still within its economic zone. And interestingly, though not directly related to the South China Sea, it was interesting that the new president of the Philippines, young Marcos, has said maybe that he would like to buy out the China State Grid share of the Philippine grid system. So yes, there's a bit of Duterte wanted to make friends with China. Marcos may be taking a more realistic view. And then, yes, as you said, Xi Jinping has been hosting a meeting in Xi'an with the leaders of the Central Asian countries, Russia not present. And I think on the energy front, the key thing was an agreement between CNPC and Kazakhstan, opposite numbers, to increase oil and gas exploration and to build new oil and gas pipelines to China. And I think this, again, is part of this sort of energy security push by China, not only domestic, that is making sure we got enough coal to keep the lights on, but also strategically longer term to make sure, try and make sure that the sea lanes of communication become less important for oil and gas imports.
Sorry, just on that, on the gas pipelines, as far as I've seen, the China-Kazakhstan, the CNPC-Kazakhstan deal didn't mention specifically the pipeline. There's an agreement that's about to expire this winter. We don't know exactly when. That's 5 BCM of gas flows, pipeline flows to China that could be expiring sometime soon. And so it's interesting to see if there's a renewal of that or any additional volumes, because without those, if demand is strong and there's a cold winter, then China could actually need more spot gas than perhaps otherwise anticipated. The other interesting thing from the Central Asian Summit was talk about Line D, so an additional pipeline from Central Asia that has been on again, off again for many, many years, and seen sort of geographically very challenging and something that was a bit of a pipe dream, no pun intended, but it, talk of it is now back. And that's as much a hedge against LNG as it is against a potential power of Siberia 2, one that I think is still very challenging, but interesting that it is being flagged and discussed once again.
Well, that's definitely something that we'll be watching as it's discussed and as we can maybe see some progress in the coming year. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Mikhail and Philip. I've appreciated and enjoyed our discussion, and we hope that you, the audience, have as well. We welcome your feedback and thoughts and look forward to our next discussion and hope you'll join us again next time. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.